I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Today, the first of what will be quite a few dialogues with candidates to be mayor of Baltimore. We'll talk with two-term City Councilman Carl Stokes, who represents the 12th District in East Baltimore, about his plans to make City Hall more transparent to taxpayers and to start an uptown renaissance to push development beyond downtown. We start the hour with a new report from the American Cancer Society, finding that black women's incidence of breast cancer has caught up with white women's, and it's more deadly for black women. Could obesity be the link? We'll talk to the Cancer Society's chief medical officer. That's Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you're with us. Later this hour, we'll be welcoming City Councilman Carl Stokes back to the show to talk about his campaign to win the Democratic nomination for mayor of Baltimore next spring. Over the fall and winter, we hope to speak with all the candidates for Baltimore's top job. Today, we welcome your comments and questions for Carl Stokes. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. We have a lot to talk about, so stay with us. We start this hour with an update on breast cancer. The American Cancer Society came out last week with an update. The good trend that's been underway for several years is that breast cancer is becoming a more survivable disease. Mortality rates have been dropping since 1990. But there's troubling news, too, that black women are more likely to die of breast cancer, 42% more likely than white women, according to the Cancer Society. And while black women used to be less likely than white women to develop breast cancer, that gap is closing. We want to understand what's behind all this. So we're pleased to welcome Dr. Otis Brawley, Chief Medical Officer of the American Cancer Society. He's also author of a book, How We Do Harm, A Doctor Breaks Ranks About Being Sick in America. Dr. Brawley joins us by phone from the American Cancer Society headquarters in Atlanta. Welcome to Midday.
Oh, thank you for having me. Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. So put this in context for us. What is going on with breast cancer and black women?
Yeah. First, let's look at getting breast cancer, the incidence rate. For years, black women have had a lower incidence rate for breast cancer, lower likelihood of getting it than white women. And that has changed over the last 15 years or so. And we've seen it inch up to now that black women have an equal chance of getting breast cancer to white women. That is attributed very heavily to an increasing problem in the American community as a whole, the black community especially, and that is obesity. Obesity causes a number of cancers, including breast cancer. Black women have gone from 15% of adult black women being obese in 1970 to 60% now.
15%, one out of six or so in 1970, to more than half now.
That's right.
And 50%. How does that compare to obesity among white women?
White women have gone from about 15% to about 35%.
So black women are more likely to be obese, and you connect that with the fact that they are now developing breast cancer at a similar rate as white women.
Well, the rate of breast cancer has gone up in black women because the obesity thing has taken off in blacks far greater than it's taken off in whites.
And is there a simple way to describe to non-scientists what it is about obesity that shows up in breast cancer?
Yeah, well, it's not just breast cancer. Obesity causes at least a dozen different cancers. We see something similar in endometrial cancer as well. We see something in prostate cancer that's related to obesity. And what many people do not realize is the combination of high caloric intake, lack of physical activity, and obesity, the three combined, are about to become the leading cause of cancer in the United States. In the next 10 years, it will surpass tobacco. You know, smoking rates have gone down dramatically, but our tendency to eat too much food, not exercise, and get overweight has gone up dramatically, and it is a huge cause of cancer. And we can get into the molecular reasons, but just take it to the bank that this problem causes breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, some pancreatic cancer, some other cancers as well.
I noticed you that one of the factors you cited was lack of activity, and obviously, I get how that contributes to obesity, because if we're taking in too many calories and not burning them up, they stack up on us. But activity itself, even if you are overweight, even if one is overweight, being active helps compensate for that.
Yeah, I actually like to think of it as a three-legged stool of obesity, high caloric intake, and too little activity. I think of it literally as a three-legged stool, and you need really the three to really increase risk of cancer.
Dr. Otis Brawley, Chief Medical Officer of the American Cancer Society, he's going to be with us just another 8 or 9 minutes, but that would be time if you have a question about breast cancer, especially if you are a Black woman who is concerned about this. He'd have time to take your call, 410-662-8780. Do I understand correctly, Dr. Brawley, also, that Black women are likely to develop types of breast cancer that are more difficult to treat?
Yes, and that's actually been linked to a couple of behavioral things, too. There's data to suggest that Black women have diets lower in fruits and vegetables, especially carotenoids, beta-carotene-containing fruits and vegetables.
Okay, that would be like what?
We're talking about melons, especially things like cantaloupe. We're talking about the bright, colory vegetables, red peppers, and that sort of thing. Carrots, things that are orange and red for the most part. Now we have data to correlate a diet lower in fruits and vegetables, a diet especially lower in fruits and vegetables that contain beta carotene, with an increased risk of the bad kinds of breast cancer. We also have data to show that women who do not breastfeed are at greater risk of the bad kinds of breast cancers. And these are all behaviors that we see very commonly in the African-American community. The diet tends to be much more meat-based, less vegetable and fruit-based, and there's been for years campaigns to actually increase the use of formula and therefore decrease the use of breastfeeding in the Black community. And this has actually come to haunt us.
And so, first of all, I should ask you, because it's such an evocative phrase, when you say bad kinds of breast cancer, I mean, obviously nobody would say there's a good kind, but what do you mean by that phrase?
A bad kind of breast cancer for me is a cancer that's harder to treat. You know, we have some cancers, especially cancers that are seen in the white Caucasian American community. A larger proportion of white women have estrogen receptor positive cancers. And actually, those are cancers that are due to some lifestyle factors, too, like not having children. This is the cancer of professional women who have never had children. Those cancers are actually easier to treat and easier to cure. The harder-to-treat cancers are the triple-negative cancers that have none of the estrogen receptors or HER2-new receptors, and many of the drugs that we use to treat cancer just don't work on them.
And, Doctor, we've been talking, when I asked you about these difficult-to-treat cancers, you have been speaking about behaviors of women. You haven't mentioned a genetic component. Is there one?
There appears to be a very small genetic component, which I would link not to race, but to area of geographic origin. The reason why I stopped is we have data to show that Black women who are treated in the Department of Defense medical system because they or their husbands are retirees from that system, their outcomes from breast cancer are very similar to white outcomes from breast cancer. Very, very similar. And so many of these problems and outcome are actually due to some behaviors. And then the other issue that we haven't talked about yet is if you are black in the United States, you are more likely to get less than optimal care once diagnosed with your breast cancer. And that actually causes a higher mortality rate as well. So we're talking about behaviors that cause breast cancers tend to cause the worst kinds of breast cancers, the harder to treat breast cancers, and then when diagnosed, less likely to get optimal care.
Donna is calling us from Baltimore. Donna, welcome to Midday.
How you doing? An excellent show. I had a girlfriend who I, for years, was trying to encourage her. She never ate fruits and vegetables. She always ate high-fat foods. And she indulged a little bit too much in alcohol and a little bit in drugs, you know, marijuana. And I had continuously saw the stats coming out about the increase in breast cancer among African Americans because of that. Her lifestyle changed. She eventually was diagnosed at 42 with stage 2 breast cancer. She went in remission for 10 years, and then eventually she succumbed to it. Mm. And so I, you know, I tried to encourage African-American women to go back into eating fruits and vegetables and to not indulge into alcohol. And I agree with your guest that alcohol and food, you know, lifestyle, obesity, all of that plays a major part. And I slowly saw my girlfriend, you know, slowly, you know, die of this. And, you know, and it's still tragic, but it can be rectified. And my question to your guests is, do African-American women have a denial factor that they, once they diagnose, do they go into a form of denial that is happening and that which makes them prevent from getting treatment early on? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you for the question. I don't want to blame black women for this, but you know, for example, when we talk about fruits and vegetables, many black people live in a desert when it comes to the availability of fruits and vegetables. They're just not available in the communities that we live in. The stores that we have to shop at just don't provide us with good fresh fruits and vegetables. And then once diagnosed, many of us, our experience has been that when our aunt or our grandparent was diagnosed with breast cancer, they died very quickly. And as a result, we have a great deal of fatalism about the diagnosis, and we don't get to see people who actually develop breast cancer, are diagnosed, and are adequately treated and do well. And so, yes, there is a huge amount of fatalism, not just in the black community, but in many communities surrounding breast cancer. And it is because many people don't get to see people who actually are treated and do well, but those people do exist.
Donna, thanks for your call. Dr. Brawley, there's another element that I want to pull into this. Just last week or the week before, there were new guidelines for mammogram screening, mm-hmm. when and how often mm-hmm. women should get mammograms. I'm not going to try to summarize it. Perhaps you could, but
sure.
I am curious as to whether increased screening, more mammograms, would have an impact on the mortality we're seeing among black women.
Increased screening absolutely would. Thank you for bringing up the guideline. The guideline is that women age 40 to 44 should have a discussion with their doctor, and they should discuss their concerns about breast cancer, their risk of breast cancer, and average-risk women should make a choice about screening. Women age 40 to 44 are at very low risk of breast cancer, by the way. Women age 45 to age 55 should get screened every year with mammography, and then women starting at the age of 55 should get screened every other year or every year if they like. Those are our new guidelines. Now, why I just said mammography helps, about a third to 40% of women over the age of 50 do not get regular screening with mammography. And we lose a lot of lives. We lose thousands of lives every year because women age 50 and above don't get mammography. Now, mammography is not a super good test. It doesn't work very well in younger women. It works really well among women in their 60s and marginally well among women in their 50s. But yet, a third to 40% probably a little higher in the black population, don't get that life-saving test in their 50s and 60s when it can be incredibly beneficial.
Before I let you go, Dr. Brawley, I'm going to throw it to you to try, because there is this, we've been talking about some very sobering statistics and trends, and yet the overall picture is of breast cancer over the last quarter century is decreased mortality. Tell us what we should leave this conversation thinking.
And that actually ties very well with the caller's question. You know, the mortality rate or risk of dying from breast cancer today is a third lower than what it was for a woman of the same age in the 1980s. Less women are dying from breast cancer because it is much more effectively treated. However, we've got a lot of technologies that we know are useful in treating this disease that a lot of women, especially black women, don't actually end up having available to them, and we need to work toward that. The other thing that people can do to help themselves prevent not just breast cancer but other cancers is try to maintain a good body weight, try to have a good diet, eating 5 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables per day, try to get some colorful fruits and vegetables into that mix. When it comes to meat, only 3 to 4 servings of beef, lamb, or pork, or processed meat per week. Try to limit meat consumption because that increases risk of cancer as well. And so the positives are you can do an awful lot to help lower your risk of cancer, and if you get cancer, be proactive with your doctor to try to make sure you're getting the best care possible and realize that the best care possible actually can save your life.
Dr. Brawley, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Otis Brawley is Chief Medical Officer of the American Cancer Society. We reached him in Atlanta. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll shift focus, talk about politics. And joining us will be mayoral candidate Carl Stokes, a 2-term member of the City Council representing the 12th District. You can be part of that conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. This is Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back in just a bit. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you're with us. The field of candidates aiming to be mayor of Baltimore keeps growing. Today, David Warnock, head of Camden Partners, a venture capital firm, threw his hat into a very crowded ring. He filed paperwork to be a candidate. We hope to speak with all the candidates before the primary next April, and today we are starting with 2-term City Councilman Carl Stokes. He represents the 12th District, the Inner East Side, and wants to represent the entire city. Councilman Stokes will be with us the rest of this hour. We hope you will be too. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or toll free. You can call 866-661-9309. Or, of course, you can always send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Carl Stokes was born in Baltimore, grew up in the city's Latrobe Public Housing Project. He was one of the first African-American students to attend the private Loyola Blakefield High School in Towson. Later, he attended Loyola College. Before he entered politics in 1987, when he was first elected to the city council, he owned a retail clothing store in the city. He left the council in 95, was appointed to the Baltimore City Board of School Commissioners. Carl Stokes is a former vice president of Mid-Atlantic Healthcare, a medical equipment and supplies company. Carl Stokes, welcome back to Midday.
Hi. Thanks, Sheila. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Why do you want to be mayor?
Well, the city needs a leader who can dramatically change the trajectory of the city in a very positive way. It needs someone who will change the financial priorities of the city. When I came back 5 years ago back to the city, in my first 10 days in City Hall, the mayor said that she was going to close 15 rec centers, about 6 pools, and cut the hours of everything. And I said, why are you going to do that? She says, we don't have enough money. I said, are you sure? She says, well, you go find the money, Stokes. And I went over to the Rec and Parks, and I said, let me see your books. And they said, we don't keep books. I said, what do you mean? You do a budget every year, right? They said, yeah. I said, how do you figure that out? She says, we don't do financials. I said, let me see your last four or five audits. And they said, we don't do audits here. And I did a little homework, and I found out that they hadn't done audits in over 30 years at Rec and Parks. And I took a small group of people, community leaders like Ralph Moore and from St. Francis Academy and members of the city council. We went outside on the corner and said, we're not closing pools and we're not closing rec centers. We're not going to do it. And we didn't close anything that year. The administration backed off. But I went farther and I began to look around at all the agencies in the cities. And you know what? Almost none of them have done audits in the last 30 years. And so I don't understand that. I'm from business. I'm from nonprofit and for-profit. And everybody audits their books and keeps financials. And this city doesn't do that. And I was so upset about that and the fact that we were throwing money away and we didn't know where it was going. But I went before the city council. I put in legislation to audit our agencies of the city every other year. Well, guess what? 11 of the 15 members of the city council voted against auditing the books of Baltimore City. And again,
and what do your fellow city councilmen tell you, city council members tell you about that vote? Why?
They said it's a waste of money. They said, why would we be spending this money? We're not going to be in trouble. What they said didn't make good sense. It wasn't good fiscal management. It was irresponsible. Meantime, in the last 5 years, the city has added 16 fees and new taxes to the citizens in this city, overburdening them. Every year for the last 5 years or so, there's been a double-digit increase in the water bill in Baltimore City. Then we added a rain tax to Baltimore City, which I just put in a bill some 4 weeks ago to cut in half. And if elected mayor, I will eliminate it altogether. It's unnecessary. We keep adding and piling. We're the highest property tax in the state of Maryland by far. We should cut that dramatically and put our financial responsibilities where they belong, in the neighborhoods, in the schools, making sure that families are able to get sustainable jobs again. You know, we take care of one neighborhood in this city. We've given almost $1 billion to Inner Harbor East and Harbor Point so that they don't pay taxes. It is unreal what's going on. And meantime, our city is suffering in the neighborhoods all across. That's black neighborhoods, that's white neighborhoods, that's middle-income neighborhoods, that's low-income neighborhoods. We're not taking care of the neighborhoods in this city, and the children of this city are suffering, and the families. And so we need a leader here who understands that, who feels the city, who's passionate about the city, and will work to change what we're doing and who we're giving money to and resources to. These resources belong in our neighborhoods.
Some would argue, of course, that the tax breaks that have been given to developers around the harbor have produced jobs, that that's exactly what the city needs.
Some would argue, and that would be the people putting billions of dollars in their pocket. That's who they would be, because it hasn't produced jobs. You know what? Most of the new buildings in Harbor East are people who worked across the street in central downtown Baltimore. Something like 8 or 10, I don't have the actual number before us, but something like 8 of 10 of new buildings in the Harbor East are taking tenants who were across Pratt Street. Now those buildings are underutilized. Now those buildings pay less taxes to the city because the value of their buildings have dropped. They weren't new people. They're not people that came from Mexico or Texas or anywhere else to these buildings. They came from central Baltimore over the line to these new buildings. They didn't produce a bunch of new jobs.
How would you describe the city's challenges following the whole Freddie Gray experience?
Well, the experience, the challenges were before Freddie Gray, of course. We had the Freddie Gray experiences because of what was happening in the city prior to that. The Freddie Gray did not cause the unrest in this city. That didn't cause the unrest. You know, I was walking on Pennsylvania North Avenue 2 days after the CVS burning with anchor from CNN, and who turned to me looking at all of the abandoned buildings that were on that street and around us. She said, "Gee, Councilman, it looks like the riot really tore this neighborhood up." And I said, "Turn around, look again. Do those boards look like they were put up 2 days ago?" "No, they're 10- and 15-year-old boards sitting on these abandoned buildings, 16,000 city-owned abandoned buildings, another 16,000 privately-owned abandoned buildings, where kids wake up every day, and what they see in front of them are all of these abandoned buildings and people standing on corners without jobs and streets that are cluttered and unclean and services not there for them and schools that don't work for them and no recreation centers for them." This is about what happened prior to, not what happened after. And, you know, people are still angry since Freddie Gray, because nothing dramatically has changed in the city since these past 6 months. Nothing. And people are angry on both sides. The police are angry because they felt like the city leadership and their own leadership let them down, didn't have their back, allowed them or didn't allow them to do their jobs. People in the community are angry because nothing dramatically has changed. No commitment, no new resources of any significant amount so that the schools are better or recreation is better or programming is better or jobs are available. No training is going on. People are still angry on both sides of this. And it's not what has changed. It's what hasn't changed in these last 6 months. The voters are very upset. And I am also angry that we and our leadership of the city has not decided to take care of the people who are most vulnerable in our city.
That's City Councilman Carl Stokes here on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We'd like you to be part of the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. If there is an issue that you would like Councilman Stokes to address, he is one of a dozen or so people running to be mayor of Baltimore. There'll be a primary election next April. So part of your platform is I think it's called an uptown renaissance in the city. Tell me what you mean by that and how you would expect
I
to get
there.
I call
it the outer harbor.
The outer harbor.
Also, listen, we can do both. We have a great inner harbor. It has been transformative for the city. It is nationally replicated. It is where people have water to do that. And I think it's a great it's a great thing for the city that we were able to do that some 40 years ago, some 30 years ago. But in all of that time when people used to tell us, if you let us do the harbor, it will trickle up. It will come out to the neighborhoods. It will come to the outer harbor, what we get from this new tourism or these new buildings. And it's never come to the community. What has happened instead is we have divested. Not only did we not invest in communities, we've divested. 14 record centers have closed in the last 5 years in the city. A couple of pools have closed. Schools have gotten worse. You know, right now, 89% of our fourth graders, 89% are below proficiency in reading and math. That means only 11% of our young people in fourth grade are at grade proficiency. And it's so normal in Baltimore, like the 300 murders we're about to have, that no one is screaming, shouting, doing anything about it. Nobody is doing anything about it. And I'm saying,
what should be done about it, that point in particular?
Let's stay there at the schools then. Obviously, I said this to the commissioner, Dr. Thornton, you ought to be able to teach first, second, and third graders how to read and do math at proficient levels. You should be able to do that. And you need to tell us what your plan is to do that. And I think that the mayor ought to control the city schools, ought to take control of the city schools instead of washing their hands as if they have no responsibility and no accountability. I know that there are many models in this city, both public and private, who are teaching kids to proficiency right now. Let's replicate the models that we have. This is about leadership. Leadership leadership in the schools, in the individual buildings, leadership at the top, and leadership at the top of government. It's leadership that we're lacking and missing, and the will to do it.
If you were elected mayor, you would not instantly have that kind of control over the
Yes, I would. I would, because I would be the mayor of the city, and I would assume that kind of control. The mayor right now appoints every member of the school board. Now, it is in, quote, conjunction with the governor, but no governor has ever pushed back on a mayoral appointment. Every person sitting on the school board has been the person that the mayor of the city has appointed and wanted to serve. And so the mayor can become the person who leads his or her school system. There's no question about it. Yes, I would have that immediately because I would assume it.
I asked you about the Outer Harbor Renaissance and then immediately asked you to linger on schools. Tell me more about how you would try to expand
economic growth
beyond the Inner Harbor.
Right. Well, first of all, I would cut dramatically the property tax rate in the city. I would go for a game-changing 50% over 5 to 8 years. I think immediately we would see an expansion of small business, a growth of small business.
This is supply-side economics.
Of course it is. It's what Walmart did. It decided to sell you Cheerios for 20 cents less, and it took the 20 cent less hit, but it expanded by a million customers, and so it became the greatest.
How would Baltimore
ever
be in a position to take the hit? I'm talking about how we get from here to there.
We would have to ask the state and maybe the federal government to help us a little bit for about 2 or 3 years, which is what Oakland and San Francisco and Boston, Massachusetts all did, and their states helped them for a few years until they got their sea legs, so to speak, and then their economies exploded. You know, when Boston and San Francisco dropped their property tax rates, they statistically were worse than Baltimore. They had higher murders. They had less economic strength than Baltimore City does now, or at that time, I'm sorry. And then they exploded because they changed their tax rate. Now, again, the politicians didn't change the tax rate. The public went to the polls and forced those places to change their tax rate. As mayor, I would work to change it along with the city council here in Baltimore City.
And are you saying essentially that in this campaign, you're running a referendum on whether or not to cut the property
that's
tax?
That's one of my platforms, certainly.
That if people want to cut the property tax.
That's one of my platforms, and audits, and just fiscal responsibility, and then putting that money back into schools and rec centers and jobs, and getting people to work at a sustainable wage, not at, you know, $7.25 an hour. Nobody can sustain themselves at that number, or frankly, it ought to be a living wage, which right now in Baltimore City is around $12 an hour.
At City Councilman Carl Stokes here on Midday, as you can hear, he is laying out what he would like to do if he can win the Democratic nomination to be mayor. We'd like to know what you think about what you're hearing, whether you agree, disagree, or have something else you'd like him to address. You can call us at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We're going to take a quick break, and Councilman Stokes will stay with us, and we hope you will too. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here with City Councilman Carl Stokes, who's telling us about his plans if he wins the Democratic nomination to become mayor of Baltimore. We'd like to know what questions you have for him. You can join this conversation at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We've got some callers, and I want to get to them soon, but I also wanted to ask you about, you had some strong opinions recently when Kevin Davis was confirmed as the city's new police chief. Why did you think he should stay as interim chief?
Because he has the same powers as interim that he would have as permanent, and I thought that I needed a plan that my constituency, black, white, brown, want to see a plan. They want to see what would be different, what is different. You know, the murder rate is going to hit 300 this year, unfortunately. And those numbers, we're number one in the country in terms of our homicide rate, number one in the country. We shouldn't be anywhere near number one in the country. I said to the commissioner, let's see the plan. Let me see people on the street. I go to New York City. I see a cop every half block. Why can't
I? We have like 8,000 police, I think, in New York City.
We have more police officers per capita than New York City. We have more police per capita than New York City. They have 8 million people live there. We have around 600,000 people living here. We have 3,000 officers. Put them on. You know what works in Baltimore City? You know how we know what's safe? When there's a Raven or Oriole game, we take officers off the street and we put them on their feet at the Camden Yards so that things are safe down there. Now, if we know putting officers visibly walking around will make things safer, because at Camden Yard, a police car doesn't drive by the stadiums and some cop looks over at the stadium and says, everything looks good, and keeps driving. Why is that the way we police in our neighborhoods? No, no, no. The officers need to be out of their cars. I say take them to the corners, drop them off, leave, and then come pick them up at the end of their shift. Put the officers on the street so they know Sheila, so they know Carl, so they know the situations that Mrs. Brown's door is open. And it's okay, because Mrs. Brown leaves the door open because she wants that fresh air to come through. But if they see Mr. Lewis's door open, something's wrong, because Mr. Lewis never leaves the door open. And so they go and knock on the door and say, Mr. Lewis, are you okay? So we need the police to know everybody in the community, the business people, the children, everybody.
You grew up in public housing.
I did.
In Baltimore.
I did.
What kind of experience with police did you as a...
Pleasant.
As an African-American boy, as a teenager?
Pleasant. I had the experience that most of my generation had, where the officer said, Carl, does Mrs. Stokes know that you're climbing on that fence, right? And I said, no, she doesn't. So this time I'm not going to take you home, but the next time I'm going to take you back to your mom and your dad. And that's the experience I had. I had an experience with officers knew me by name, knew Mrs. Stokes by name, and knew where I lived, and made sure, as best they could, that I stayed out of trouble, without harassing me, without brutality, without calling me out my name. These were white cops and black cops, and they all treated me respectfully as a kid, and they treated most everyone else. But, you know, there were people in the neighborhood who were thugs of some sort, right? And you know what? They didn't treat them as respectfully. And the community was glad they didn't. Now, they didn't brutalize anybody. They didn't do nonsensical things for the most part. But the cops knew the difference between the guys who were just kids having fun, mischievous, and the guys who were out for bad.
What kind of response do you get if you describe that experience with police? How does that play among your constituents now? Do they believe it? Do they say, "Yeah, I've had the same
pretty much
experience.
They have the same experience. The difference is that our cops lived in Baltimore City. That our cops lived the neighborhood over. That our cops knew us, and their families lived in Baltimore City. So our cops knew the challenges and wanted to be sure that the city was safe, because their children were growing up in the city. Their spouses were in the city. And so our officers wanted to be sure that we had a great, safe city for their own families as well as our families.
That's City Councilman, mayoral candidate Carl Stokes here on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. This is WIPR. And if you'd like to be part of this conversation, give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Melissa is calling us from right here in Charles Village. Hello, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Councilman Stokes.
Hi, Melissa.
I'm a constituent of yours, and I'm actually originally from Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested to hear you cite the reduction in property taxes in Boston. So first of all, that reduction in property tax was the result of a state ballot initiative, Proposition 2.5.
It was a what? I'm sorry.
It was the state ballot initiative.
Yeah, that's what I said.
2.5.
I did say that. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, but it wasn't just in Boston. And the effect of that Proposition 2.5 in Massachusetts, where I grew up, was extremely harmful, particularly to communities of color. The state did not bail out those communities. The state is unlikely to bail out Baltimore. And what happened was an exacerbation of disparities in education, in property tax revenue, because there's an override process in that law. And wealthy communities do what wealthy communities always do. They overrode Proposition 2.5, and wealthy communities continue to fund things for kids, and poor communities didn't and couldn't. And you have an exacerbation in the greater Boston area based on Proposition 2.5. So if that's your plan, you've lost my vote.
I understand, Melissa. Thank you for calling. And I say it is a matter of priorities of the leadership. There was more money. There was greater economic growth in Boston. There's no doubt about that. Same in other cities. And it's the leadership who then decided what their priorities are. And I've just said to you, as best I could, that my priorities are taking care of neighborhoods, all of the neighborhoods, those who are most vulnerable in our city. And I think we have to grow our tax base. We have to do that. We cannot be a poor city and be able to fund the priorities that we need to fund.
Melissa, I appreciate your call. I think Al from Pasadena also wants to be on the same point. Al, welcome to Midday.
Oh, thank you very much. And Councilman, thanks for being there. There was a lot of stuff you said, but to piggyback on the last caller, if you look at, say, San Francisco specifically,
okay,
they, you know, have reduced property taxes. They've done a lot of stuff to encourage business, give them breaks. And if you look at the amount of communities that have been displaced in San Francisco of working people, minority people, who can no longer afford to live in their communities, I'm talking whole communities with churches and grocery stores, and not only the people, but local merchants, small business grocers, and other things, they can no longer afford because they don't have the customers anymore that they catered to because their prices are reasonable. Now they have to raise their prices astronomically to cover their taxes and their rents, and the people that live there can no longer buy their food. So to think that that helps local communities and poor communities is ridiculous, because the places you cited, it's clear that it has not helped them.
I think you're wrong, and I'll give you more information as we continue this campaign. And again, it's the leadership who sets the priorities. I hear you. I respect your perspective on that, and I will argue it throughout the campaign. Thank you.
Thank you, Al, for calling us. I want to pick up, you just a minute ago used the phrase growing our tax base, which ties in, of course, to an issue that you have fought hard about, the TIFs, the tax increment financing, and mm-hmm. the pilots, the payment in lieu
right.
of taxes, the tax breaks that have gone to
sure.
developers, because although on paper Baltimore's tax base has grown, a lot of the property tax revenue that might have come in mm-hmm. from those developments has been forgiven for
right.
long periods of time.
Right.
You've tried to address that.
Yes.
You haven't succeeded as a councilman in
no.
changing it.
I have not, and I will change that as mayor. Look, we've used the TIFs and pilots in some good ways, Belvedere Square, Mondawmin Mall. There was no need for us. There was a good reason to start giving some tax abatement and tax credits in the Inner Harbor, Harbor East, rather. But then at a point, we helped them to develop. At a point, they were grown up, and they could take care of themselves. The last one was just a bad deal for the city all around. I believe we should use the tools that we have judiciously around the city, particularly in the Outer Harbor, I call it, in the uptown neighborhoods, middle-income neighborhoods, neighborhoods that are on the cusp, I say, that are struggling. I don't think we can pour money into neighborhoods that are really, really depressed. Frankly, I think that that's not the place to start. I think we have to build from strength. I think we have to look at our middle-income neighborhoods and those that are just next door to those middle-income neighborhoods and bring them all up as strongly as we possibly can. And I think that in some of those cases we can use. But here's what I don't like so much about the tax increments that we're using. It is
the tax breaks.
The tax breaks, right. I think that we're we have 16 different tax breaks that people can use in the city. I think we should lower the taxes for everybody across the city, have one fair rate, and not give out to this special group or this special developer or this special person a large tax break while everybody else who is sitting and working on the Social Security or pension or fixed income, they continue to have to pay the full rate while other people get a special break. I think that that's patently unfair and that we should make a tax rate that works for everybody and we should lower the cost of the water in the city of Baltimore.
Let's talk to Howard in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday, Howard.
Good morning, or good afternoon, rather.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Howard, what are your thoughts?
Well, I had first a short statement and then a question.
We're kind of tight for time. Why don't we go straight to your question?
Well, I didn't grow up in Pasadena nor Boston. I grew up at Flag House Project, born and raised here in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
I base what I want to do on what a person's done. I've seen Representative Stokes and appreciate what he's done. My question is, what is his, he mentioned his concern and interest correctly, so about the closing of rec centers. What is his actual plan in terms of, say, for example, summer jobs for the youth, and as well as, because I've been involved in mentoring for the last decade.
Okay, well, why don't we focus on that? Summer jobs. Thanks, Howard.
I think we should do what was done in Washington, D.C. For many years, which is that every young person who wanted a job received a job in Washington, D.C., either working for the government or for private business. The mayors of Washington, D.C. made sure that there were enough jobs, and no one ever got turned away. There was never a quota. There was never, we got to stop at 5,000 or whatever the number might be. Every young person who wants a job should be given a job, and I think we can do that in Baltimore City. In addition, most high school students in Baltimore City need part-time work, most, to take care of their needs. Their families are poor. You know, 85% of our students live in poverty. And so these high school students have ongoing needs, and they can't get it from their families because they can't afford it.
Jess is calling us from Waverly. Jess, we're almost out of time. Can you give us a quick question?
Yes. I wanted to say thank you so much for all the passion that you have about the communities in Baltimore. And I lived in Waverly for 20 years, and the number one problem that I saw was drugs, the drug addiction, the drug trade, and it decimated the community and decimated the families. And I just wanted to hear the plan that you have to start turning that around. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Education and jobs. Education and jobs. People need hope. They are self-medicating, many people. You know, they self-medicate whether they live in $1 million home or whether they live in a $15,000 home. People need to have hope and be able to sustain themselves and their families. Education, jobs.
Thank you, Congressman Carl Stokes. Oh, Congressman, goodness.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know. City Councilman Carl
you,
Stokes,
Sheila.
Running
so
to be mayor of Baltimore. And thanks to our listeners. Thanks to Ciparelli's in Little Italy for lunch for Midday Guests today. It's available for dine-in, carry-out, or catering located at 237 South High Street. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you've been with us. Tomorrow we'll be joined by Ned and Constance Sublette, authors of a very troubling book called The Slave Coast. Tune in for that. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.
This is your NPR news station, WYPR. Here and Now is coming up next. It'll be followed this afternoon at 3 by Fresh Air, and then at 4 by All Things Considered. And be sure to stay tuned at 6:30 for business news on Marketplace.
Uber takes a lot of heat for the way it classifies its drivers as contractors instead of employees. The company's comeback goes a little bit like this.
The Uber platform technology is now making it easier for people to add to their income.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Chief Advisor David Plouffe on Uber and the freelance economy. That is next time on Marketplace from APM.
Join us for that story, plus the day's top business news from Wall Street and around the world. Catch Marketplace at 6:30 this evening here on your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.